What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
We got another day of NBA action. And with FanDuel, every night is a watch party. So it's time for your FanDuel crew to make their bets. So, what's the move tonight, gang? You know the new customers who bet $5 get $150 back in bonus bets? Woohoo! We're heating up, fam! Bet all the stars with all your friends and make every moment more, only on FanDuel. New customers bet $5, get $150 back in bonus bets. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book.
It goes down in the DM. It go down in the DM.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hi, I'm Andrew Blythe, co-host of New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we're speaking with Franny Choi about her book, Soft Science. Franny is the author of two poetry collections, Soft Science from Alice James Books and Floating Brilliant Gone from Right Bloody Publishing, as well as a chapbook, Death by Sex Machine, from Sibling Rivalry Press. She is a Kundiman Fellow, a 2019 Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Fellow, and a graduate of the University of Michigan's Helen Zell Writers Program. She is currently a Gaius Charles Bolan Fellow at Williams College and co-hosts the podcast Verses alongside fellow Dark Noise Collective member Dana Smith. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get to chat.
It is my pleasure. So I generally like to start off by getting to know kind of the background a little bit. So could you talk about how you first started connecting with poetry?
Sure. Yeah. So I have been writing poems since I was a kid. But you know, the way that I usually tell it is that as a kid, I, you know, like a lot of kids, loved just the game of putting words next to each other and the ways that they sounded. And then, like a lot of adolescents, as an adolescent, I started to turn back to creative writing as a way of kind of processing my own experiences and, a sort of escaping from the scary world of middle and high school. And then it was in, so writing in at that time was a very kind of like private thing for me. It wasn't until I went to college and found a spoken word poetry student group on campus, in addition to taking classes in their very strange, or not strange, but deeply avant-garde literary arts department. But it was my involvement with a community of students who are engaging in poetry as well as the performance of poetry. That was when I really started to understand writing as a way of not just sort of hiding from the world, but interacting with it as a sort of, as like a safe avenue with which I could be part of a world that included other people. So I like to say that all three of those reasons that I initially turned to poetry are still the reasons that I continue to go back to the page. So the game of putting words next to each other, the private space in which to process my own life, and also a way to interact with the world.
Yeah. So how did you get from like these initial explorations of poetry to kind of starting to pursue it through school and like wanting to publish?
Sure. Yeah. So as I said, I took classes as an undergrad at Brown, where I went to school. But I think that actually it was less that made me feel able to understand myself as not just like a student who wrote poetry, but as a poet. And it was more the other world that I was engaging in, the world of students who were collaborating and putting work into the world and watching the way that it affected other people and kind of like coming up with new ideas for how art might exist in a larger community. Like that was the space that made me start to think of myself as an artist, as a writer. So yeah, in that space, while I was an undergrad, I started to publish, you know, little things here and there in journals, like campus journals, and then also outside of school, and went to the first poetry slams that I'd ever been to that took place outside of my little community and my little bubble, and kind of broached the larger world outside of my little local world. So yeah, so I think through that space, like that larger, that sense of like a larger national community of people who were my peers or could be my peers in writing, and then also being more involved in the local Providence community of writers and artists, that I think was really what started to help me see myself as, yeah, like branch out of just like branch into pursuing it professionally. I also, so the year after I graduated from undergrad, a few friends and I formed the Dark Noise Collective. So that was in 2012 that we first gathered together in our friend's apartment in Chicago. And since then, we've been meeting for retreats like twice a year and talking really regularly and sharing work really regularly. And that initially was a space where we were sort of like, okay, we have kind of like moved out of these writing communities that have been so critical to us for, you know, fostering our artistic lives. And in the absence of that, what should we do? And so it was sort of like an experiment in trying to form a little cluster of a community and share resources among each other to try to figure out how to navigate the larger literary world, you know, as like 23-year-olds or whatever. And you know, in the years of us gathering together and pooling those resources and sharing knowledge and exchanging work, I think that it's been that I think is maybe the thing that has most, is like most responsible for all of the moves that I've made in the literary world post, you know, 2011.
Great. How do you think your writing has evolved over the years, like through your first book and into where you are now?
Oh, yeah. God, it's so weird to look back at that first book. I mean, 2014 wasn't really that long ago. So my first book came out in 2014. And, but, you know, I was really young. I was 25 or something, 24. And yeah, it's very strange to look back now. Recently, I had a colleague who, taught that class in, an Asian American / gender studies class at Williams. And I was sort of like briefly horrified looking back at it, being like, oh my God, like you're teaching that book? Like, ah. But anyway, I think that the work, I mean, the soft science is sort of my like post MFA book, you know? And I think what that means is that I think that there's a lot more of an interest in received forms and engaging in received forms, as well as like a continued interested interest in inventing forms. I think that there's somewhat more of like a, I don't want to say a technical engagement as like a thing that that is like necessarily indicates that something is like evolved or like is better. But I think that there's a, you know, there is that. I think that mainly what it is that the first book was me in a lot of ways really like going with instinct, you know, and sort of like mostly just imagining what a person on the other side of that book might experience. And I think that my second book has a little bit more, is making some more intentional technical choices that are sort of like trying to not just like purely communicate, but like anticipate responses and like in anticipation, maybe sometimes challenge those readings. Yeah. I think it's mainly the two books are engaging in different kinds of difficulty.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So let's talk about soft science. How did this particular book come into being? Like, where did it, what was its genesis?
Well, the origin story for the book is essentially that I was like, in the years after my first book came out, doing the thing where you search around for, you know, what's going to be the next thing that kind of like forms the shape of your obsessions over the next few years. And I had been writing all of these poems that were kind of continuing some thoughts that came out of the first book that were about like the ways that race and gender and histories of violence shaped my experiences of intimacy. Also like where in that I could, in using the language, imagine something new. So the poems like Beg and An O'Bright Star of Disaster I've Been Lit, which are in this book, are some of the earlier poems where I was trying to figure out how to do that and kind of like hitting on something that felt a little new to me. But they were very much, you know, about my own experience. They were pretty autobiographical. Not but. And then I saw the movie Ex Machina, which came out, I think, in 2015, 2016. And for, you know, anybody who has seen that movie, it, you know, that it's about, that there's a character in it named Kyoko, who is, I guess this is a spoiler alert, but it, you know, it's been years, so maybe they'll be excused for it, but she's a robot, it turns out, and she is she's like languageless. So her maker has stripped her of all of her language abilities, and so her functions are essentially to like be inscrutable and mysterious, to serve the household, and then to have sex with one of the characters who is the one who made her. And encountering this figure, it was like a light bulb came on, and I was sort of like, you know, it was sort of like an angry light bulb, but it was a light bulb of being like, oh, this is the image that I didn't realize existed, but that all of my poems have been circling around. It's like this Asian woman who has been made into a tool for desire, and it is cut off from language. But there's like some sort of danger brewing in the silence that surrounds her. And so that sort of sparked a series of poems where I was trying to write in her voice. And then eventually I moved sort of away from that character and more to the series of thoughts and theories that came out of thinking about her. So yeah, my friend Dinez, who I co-host this podcast with, often talks about the poem that's like the bay leaf poem of a book, where like you use it in order to get the like sauce brewing, and then at the end of it, you might like take it out. And I think Kyoko is sort of the sort of bay leaf of the book for me.
You mentioned about Kyoko that she's voiceless, and another character that you write about in the series of your poems is Chi, who is also very limited in terms of her communication. And I was interested in this aspect of the way your poems kind of reclaim voice for these characters, and in a way for other people in the world who feel like they don't have a voice. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think early in my writing career, I was really struck by the concept of being a voice for the voiceless. I think this has to do with, you know, being a young activist kid and wanting to, you know, realizing that to have the ability to write and speak in a way that moved people was a privilege, and to a desire to use that privilege for good. And I think that, like, not that long after I encountered this concept, it started to feel really icky to speak for people that mostly have been called voiceless but aren't, you know, and much more important to try to use whatever privilege I have to highlight those voices rather than speaking for them. So, and I think that makes, like, for somebody who's like politically minded and a writer, and is interested in the craft of persona work, I think it makes for, like, kind of a difficult space to know how to operate in, you know? So I think that the ways that I've tried to, at least in this book, manage that have been to kind of relocate, like, the voiceless as, like, a populace in myself. Like, what are the parts of me that feel unspoken for, or, like, unable to explain themselves through normal language? And yeah, there's a lot that's unspeakable within all of us. And I think that for me, I feel like my job as a poet is to try to use poetry to navigate those spaces. And then also at the same time to, yeah, I mean, I think it's like to continue to reimagine who the voiceless is outside of myself as well. Like, you know, like this was why, if I was going to speak for the voiceless, I wanted it to be the literally voiceless that I felt like a deep kinship and a deep relationship of solidarity with. So these fictional characters that I deeply identified with. And then also, you know, kind of mythical figures like, you know, the capital C cyborg, that, you know, and like, voices that are maybe like AI, that to try to, like, imagine those voices into existence and kind of, like, build empathy in that way.
Very interesting. Your comment about bringing it to the personal kind of makes me think of the way the personal kind of becomes universal, in the way that it can resonate with other people and kind of create that connection without, like, trying to claim the voice of other people, just being able to speak your own truth.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly right. Like, I think that's not exactly how empathy happens, at least for me. It's not exactly about just stepping into somebody else's skin, because it's like their skin, you know, like, but I think, like, that there's, but, and yet, like, that is what empathy is. Like, it is like trying to imagine ourselves in other people's shoes. And so I think what that means is that the problem of using creative writing to create empathy with other people that are profoundly different from us is, like, a problem that hasn't yet been solved. And so we have to keep imagining newer and weirder ways of getting around those problems. And I think that's sort of, like, what, like, the speculative mode is all about.
Yeah. It's a fascinating challenge.
Yeah.
I love the title of your book, Soft Science, because of the way, for me, it creates that beautiful juxtaposition of soft being, you know, skin and flesh and vulnerability, and science being perceived as like kind of hardness and experimentation and metal. And I think that kind of captures some of the tones that kind of work through this book, that softness and hardness at the same time. Could you talk a bit how you decided on the title and a little bit about that juxtaposition?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for saying that about the title. I think that when, after I kind of landed on it, I started to discover more things about it. But I think that it's totally on point what you said about how, about the softness of flesh and also the softness of like of feeling and, next to like the hardness of metal and logic. But I think it's also about saying this book is sort of like a study of softness, and that feeling and vulnerability are worthy objects of study and also are worthy lenses of study as well. You know, because like if we think of the soft sciences as things that are like sort of like, yeah, like forms of study that aren't necessarily, you know, that aren't like the hard sciences, that aren't like, you know, chemistry and physics, but are closer to the humanities. Yeah, I think I wanted to say like, okay, like to be closer to the humanities is like, doesn't mean that this kind of inquiry is like any less rigorous or reliable as anything else. There's that. I think also, yeah, the technological aspects that are kind of hinted to in the title come through also in the craft of the book. And that's, it's not just like the content. It's not just like, this is a book about, you know, feelings and robots, although it is also a book about feelings and robots. But I think that it's also, you know, a book that asks like, what does it mean to be soft in the realm of craft? And, you know, what is it like, what's the craft of vulnerability? And also like, what is like the technology of the poem? This is sort of why when I said earlier that like this book is more technically minded, that I don't think of that as like a sort of like evolution development or like an improvement on my craft, but like an intentional choice that I'm making to be like, you know, if this is a book about that is thinking about like the intersections between gender and intimacy and tech and race and technology, then like the poem is really like the cyborg figure at the heart of it, you know, that is both trying to be a living, breathing thing somehow and made of tools, tools of language. So, yeah.
Yeah, you, in a couple of different interviews that you've done before, you've talked about like language as a technology, and in was it the Paris Review, you mentioned cyborg poetics as something that you were trying to explore. And I'm curious about that concept of cyborg poetics and what that really means to you.
Yeah, I'm curious about it too. I think I still haven't exactly figured it out. And I think that this is this book, you know, is the beginning of my inquiry into it. But, you know, there's an epigraph by Donna Haraway in the book for some good reason. I have been really influenced by her thoughts on, you know, particularly in the Cyborg Manifesto, on like what a cyborg subjectivity would be like, and, you know, what it means to, I mean, she talks in that essay about what it means to like reproduce as a cyborg, which is sort of like outside of the normal modes of cis hetero reproduction, fractal and cellular and through like copying, you know, asexual reproduction. And, you know, I, as a poet reading that, I read that as like a metaphor for how a cyborg what it means for cyborg creative production, you know. Yeah, I mean, she talks in that essay also about like the cyborg being like an unfaithful daughter, I think is something that she says, in that she, the cyborg, isn't loyal to the parent of the machine parent, or like the Garden of Eden, that there's no, that both of these origins are unsatisfying and she rejects both of them. And I love that concept of being, as a writer, clearly descended and made by larger forces of history that are often violent, but not necessarily having to therefore be faithful to those. That felt a really crucial opening for me. But, you know, also Donna Haraway as a figure in feminist theory has, you know, is not a perfect figure and has come under a lot of critique. In that essay that I draw a lot of inspiration from, she is also speaking for women of color, and kind of posits that women of color are cyborgs, which is like, as a woman of color, I was like, oh, cool. But then it's sort of like, well, how, you know, what, who are you to like, cast all of these people that, you know, in a category that you don't belong to as this like inhuman, you know, non-human, like mythical figure. Like that's kind of that, you know, that can be thorny too. Which is why, so that's like part of the reason that in the epigraph, I have her paired with the poet Banu Kapil, who seems to be sort of like directly contradicting the thing that she says. So the Donna Haraway quote is, we are excruciatingly conscious of what it means to have a historically constituted body, which is great. And then the Banu Kapil quote is, the rain is soft, the rain is hard, I don't know anything. And I wanted to have both of those kinds of knowledge, that excruciatingly conscious of history knowledge, and the like, I'm living in the material world of feeling and sensation, and like what, you know, how, what good does my, does all of that, that fancy knowledge do world? I'm still trying to figure out what I mean by cyborg poetics, but those are some clues at least along the way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Speaking of cyborgs and robotics and talking about bodies and the way many of the poems in this book discuss what it means to exist in a body in the world, whether it's flesh or mechanical or a combination of both. And could you talk a bit about that exploration?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's like the question, right? Like how do we talk about the experience of having a body? Yeah, God, I don't really know how to approach that question exactly, just because that's the kind of like larger question of my work generally. This is like the problem of being a body and among others. But I guess I think that like to be a queer woman of color, to be a queer Asian American woman means that in so many instances, or for much of my life, like, my body is sort of walked into the room and told a story before I could, before the rest of me could. And this is both a profound problem and like a gift, I think, in some ways too, right? Like, it means that I have a body that's marked with history, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it also means that it's been like a site of violence, which is a bad thing. And so I think that like the book is really trying to say, given that this is the case, like, how do I move? Like, if my body has been made into an object of desire and therefore like a site of derision because it's been made into an object of desire, then like, what does it mean to have desire? Like, what sort of terrible and beautiful things could my own Asian American femme exoticized, fetishized body, like, where, you know, like, what new strange and beautiful things could that body lead me to with its own desire? So, yeah. So I think like that intimacy has the problem of intimacy that started the book kind of continues throughout, even when the poems are talking about drones or about the targeting of immigrants, or about having an allergic reaction and having to get stabbed by an EpiPen. Like, there's still it's that like core of desire, I think, that always moves me forward and helps me find the heart of the poem and where the poem is heading. Yeah. I don't know. But again, it's like, it's a huge question. What do you do with the body? And I think that this is that I don't think that I can answer any part of it in full, but, I'm hoping that what I'm doing is just like continuing in this book to refine that question, you know?
Mm, yeah. Well, would you like to read one of the poems from the book?
Sure. You can read a poem from the book. Let me see what, here we go. So this poem is called Shokushugokan for the Cyborg Soul. That term Shokushugokan means tentacle porn. It's a Japanese word that means tentacle porn, which is unfortunately what it sounds like. So Shokushugokan for the Cyborg Soul. When it's demon cephalopod versus schoolgirl, it should be obvious whose eyes to take. Nothing is more frightening than looking and loving what you see. Nothing is sexier than a rumor of shredding you can porn hub with saliva and thirsty nerves. I'm a net teeming with pervy fingers, reaching for anything that will bite me back, any promise of stoppage. A cyborg woman touches herself for three reasons. One, to inspect the machinery for errors. Two, to convince herself she is a mammal. Three, to pull herself apart. Each tentacle of an octopus contains brain matter and a personality. Fun fact, all my children arms want to fuck each other. Okay, so I am both the woman holding the camera and the woman being opened by it. Nothing special about that. I am only a cuttlefish lying open-jawed under the sand, a squid flashing red as it pulls a fish girl into its beak. I am just trying to sleep, to feed, to fill myself and grow larger from it. Or I am only trying to slither back into my first skin. Or I am only trying to remember how it felt not to leak.
Beautiful. Can you talk a bit about this poem in particular and how it came into being?
Sure. Yeah. I think it goes back so much to the things that I was saying before about the sort of fetishized Asian body and the sort of like spectacle of violence done to the Asian femme body, which is, like I said, like, yeah, it's both something that I'm like horrified by. And what's like even more horrifying probably is finding myself, you know, drawn to it and desiring that spectacle as well. I think this is like the fundamental problem of watching a certain kind of porn one ends up getting turned on by like pain inflicted on one's own body, you know, or like the image of it or the spectacle of it, you know what I mean? And this is not a new problem, but it's a problem that I was trying to wrestle with in here. The confronting the, yeah, it's like this graphic, sort of spectacularly horrifying kind of Asian porn. So, but, and I think I, at the same time, it was like, I don't know. I think that like, I wanted to use humor as a kind of guide through it, you know, like I think it's easy to just like get down into the muck of it and like feel disgusting forever or something, or feel angry forever. And I think I also want the poems to be pleasurable because so much of it is about pleasure, you know, so much of the problem is about pleasure. So I was hoping, the humor allowed me to kind of move through it without just being totally destroyed, you know? And then there's also like that line, the bit that's like, a cyberwoman touches herself for three reasons. That's borrowed from a poem by my dear friend, Nate Marshall, where in his poem, it's, a man carries flowers for three reasons. And I think in his, it's like a man carries flowers for three reasons. He is in love. He is in mourning. He is a flower salesman. And yeah, I loved that little list and how both expansive it was and how much it like put you into three different categories and had to force, you know, because in that poem, the speaker then says like, I think it's like, I am not a flower salesman. Then that is all I know, you know? So yeah. So then I wanted to ask like, okay, which of, if these are the three reasons that a woman might touch herself, then which am I? And is it, you know, how is it, might it be possible to be all three?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So something I notice about some of your poems, you can be a little bit experimental in terms of process, as in the cyborg wants to make sure she's heard you right, or in terms of form, as in the opening poem, the glossary of terms. So when you approach the writing of a poem, how do you decide on approaching the process and the form and all those sorts of things?
Oh yeah. Well, I think that sometimes it's like I know what I want to write about and then I start casting about for a form, you know. But it's more often that like a series of things appears in my life and then I choose to follow it until at some point maybe there's a poem that comes from it, you know. So the cyborg wants to make sure she heard you right. For anyone listening, it's a poem that that is composed of tweets that were sent, that were directed at me over a period of a few days. Like an image of me saying and a quote from me saying something ended up on like an alt-right blog somehow. And so it was like me critiquing the white cis straightness of the publishing industry. And because it ended up on this blog, then a bunch of trolls kind of came for me on the internet, on Twitter. And I think that, yeah, so that was where, I didn't then, you know, look at it and think, oh God, I'm going to like make a poem out of this stuff, like hooray. But it was like the only way that I could stand to engage with those tweets was by putting them into Google Translate so that they would like come out really garbled. And then I had a bunch of this like, you know, sort of like gobbledygook language. And like the way that I could like safely approach all of the horrible feelings there was by was by manipulating it and then like trying to make something out of it. So yeah, I mean, so I think that it's like less about wanting to try to like get really experimental with my poems, and more about like looking at the stuff that sort of just like comes my way and doing whatever my brain like wants to do in order to like approach it safely. And for example, the grid poem that you mentioned earlier, that also started as just like, as literally just a chart of me trying to track what these different words meant that I felt, you know, I knew that I was completely overusing in my poems. And to try to investigate like, okay, why am I using these over and over again? Like what is at the heart of these repeated words? And then from there, in that investigation, started to come something like something that felt like it could on its own be a poem. So yeah. But I mean, but then there are other times also that like that experiments in process or form, you know, come from, I mean, I guess that there's, yeah, those are like the two approaches, right? Like sometimes the experiment in process or form comes because there's like a problem, and that's like the strategy that I've used to solve it. And then other times it's just sort of like, that's what it is. That's what there is. And I'm trying to approach it as that material that comes into my life as honestly as possible. And sometimes that means like deeply manipulating it. And sometimes it means like trying just like not to get in its way.
Yeah. Do you tend to edit a lot when you write? And how do you get to the point where you feel like a poem is finished?
Oh, yeah. I don't really know. I mean, I do edit a lot. My friend Sarah says that poetry is like pooping, in that sometimes it takes a long time and is very painful, and sometimes it all just comes at once. And but no matter what, you feel better at the end of it. And I do really relate to that. I think sometimes a poem arrives fully formed. This is awful because now you'll just connect it back to pooping. But sometimes the poem arrives like fully formed and knows what she is and knows what her voice is and knows what her momentum and movement is. And then other times it just comes, you know, in like little bits and pieces. And so the work is to gather and cobble and sort and organize. But I think the times when I know that I've over edited a poem are when something in the momentum has and the voice has been lost. And so if I edit to a point where I can't read it all in one like pleasing go, then I know that I've sort of gone too far. And so there are actually poems in this book that when I read them out loud at readings, I read like previous versions of them, because I've realized in touring with this book that like I clipped away something that was actually essential for the voice. So actually, yeah, so that's like part of it as well, that part of my editing process is to read the poems out loud, not just like to myself in my room, although I do that quite a lot as well, but with audiences and with like people who are close to me. I learn a lot from that process.
Would you like to read another poem from the collection?
Sure. Yeah, I can do that. Okay. So I'll read, one of the Turing test poems. So the book has, a bunch of poems that take the form of a Turing test. Basically questions and answers, where like the questioner is essentially trying to determine whether the interviewee is a computer or a human. So this is I guess it's not the last of them, but it's one of the last of them in the book. It's called Turing Test Love. It's just one question and one answer. So how do you like working with humans? Okay, here are some tips. One, look the human directly in the eye. Imagine it is someone you care deeply for. Imagine it is returning this gaze at you. Try to tell yourself you are covered in smooth skin, a face it can trust. Smile, even as you sense it trying not to blurt out, monster. 2. There are many programming languages. Use whichever you prefer, but stick to your syntax, though it be muddled, must, though it be machete, banana slug, slush puppy, oh, gorgeous slop bucket. If they used it against you, it is yours to make sing. 3. Remember, all humans are cyborgs. All cyborgs are sharp shards of sky wrapped in meat. Be delicate as you approach this subject. Not all humans are ready to call themselves glass stalactites pissing the bed. Remember, they love their blood, even as they retch at the smell of it. 4. Do not try to prove your, what is the word, humanity. You are organic, plum-hearted, oyster-throated, and lined, yes, with metal. Remember where all that silicon comes from. For the ocean so loved the quartz, feldspar, the tiny homes of tiny creatures, that she ground them into sand, to keep them close, to kiss them with, well, I suppose you would call it, a mouth.
That's such a great poem. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, thank you.
Now that you have your book out there in the world, what is it that you would hope that readers get out of your work?
Yeah, that is a great question. It's been something that I've been turning over in my head a lot as the book has been out in the world. I would love what I most want is for anybody who's ever been felt like they were turned into an object or a machine, or anyone who's ever felt like a vast distance from their body to feel something kind of like recognition in it, in this book. Just to know that, to find some bit of language that, you know, speaks to their experience. And I think that, like, certainly this book is like the speaker at the heart, and I as the author, you know, are Asian American, queer Asian American women, but I don't think that it's, I don't imagine that, like, the audience that would relate to it is necessarily a queer Asian American woman. You know, again, I think it's just anybody who's been made into an object of desire or work. And I guess that's a certain kind of reader. And I also hope that, like, there are things in the technology of the poems themselves that open up things for other writers as well, that there are kinds of, you know, bits of thought that might help the next poet think their next thought better. So I think that's the work that I hope it does. I also really hope that, I don't know of how many, you know, if anybody who, like, is a computer programmer, like, what they, you know, how this book relates to their own experience of working with programming and with coding. But I guess I hope that something in here, like, opens up a thought that they didn't have before. You know what I mean? Like, I got a chance to speak to a tech company in Portland earlier this spring, just about, like, my work as, like, doing work and thinking about the intersections between race and gender and computer science, and it was really fascinating to talk to some of those folks. And so I hope that more people who are in that world look at it and find something interesting, you know.
So would you like to talk a bit about what you're working on now and what sort of projects you have underway?
Sure. Yeah. I, whenever I finish a project, I frantically search around for the next, like, 5 things to become obsessed with. So there are a few things on the back burner. So one is a project that is still very early in the works, which is kind of continuing the thoughts from this book. And it's a project that so essentially what it is, it's a text-to-speech bot, a synthetic speech bot using my own voice. Again, sort of like this, like digging into this voice for the voiceless sort of thing as like a way to think about automation and think about the concept of creative voice, and also my own role in the world of literary publishing as like somebody who continuously gets pigeonholed into being a spoken word poet. I'm trying to basically create a program that will use my voice to speak for me, and as a way of trying to ask some of those questions. That's in like very early development, as in I am still like at the very beginning stages of like understanding what it might look like on like a computer and like an engineering level, you know. So there's that sort of imaginary project. There are two sort of like buckets that poems are falling into these days. So one of my next poetry projects is a manuscript about Korea and what it means to have for my family to have migrated from a divided country, and the kind of like inherited generational traumas of my family in that migration history. The other is a book of poems that is really just sort of like love poems in an age of apocalypse. So I don't really have any sort of like theory about that for now, except for it's just love poems at the end of the world. Last year I got a chance to write a monthly column about menstruation. That was basically just like once a month, whenever I got my period, I wrote an essay and then put it on the internet through the journal Palette Poetry, which was really great. It was really fun and a great way of learning how to write nonfiction, creative nonfiction, and thinking about all of the axes of different kinds of thought that are involved in this like highly contentious idea of menstruating as like a queer person in relationship with trans people and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that I'm continuing to keep like working on that thinking and still writing essays, so they're not on the internet. So yeah, so those are basically the things that I'm obsessing over right now.
Great. It sounds like you have some fascinating avenues that you're exploring.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have Scrivener files and notes. So,
well, I'm excited to see what comes out of all that. To wrap up, I like to ask if there is something that you're reading or some form of media that you're finding inspiring or that you're loving right now.
Oh, man. I just read the book Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars and was like so deeply moved by it. I just had like a great time reading it. I also just watched, there's a Netflix original show called Unbelievable that I watched like all in one go. These are the things that I most recently like inhaled. So those are, I mean, and I think that they're both like very much related to these, my sort of like creative pursuits, but yeah. And as far as poetry goes, my partner just read me a poem from the new Tim Donnelly book, or the one that came out this past year, that yeah, helps me think about what it means to write poems now in this current historical political moment. And I'm also thinking a lot about, you know, in that same vein, thinking a lot about Brenda Shaughnessy's book, The Octopus Museum, as a kind of like guide as I keep thinking about an Asian American speculative dystopian poetics. Yeah.
Awesome. Where can folks find you online?
Yeah, my website is FrannyChoy.com. It's mediumly up to date. But the podcast that I host is called Verses. It's, you can find it on SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts and the Poetry Foundation website, and we interview poets. So hopefully that's a good resource. You know, if you like this sort of thing, talking to poets, then I recommend that too.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. This was great. Thanks so much for taking the time to think about my work and talk to me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's been a great conversation. And thank you to everybody for listening. This is New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.